He was a wonderful fella, great man for Ricka. Well, going back in sort of ancient history, I well remember that, well, in 1906, Mr. Turney, I went into hardware business with Mr. Turney, and we, at that time, we of course had to deliver most stuff. And we had a man by the name of Silas Tabor, who was famous here for making wagons. He made light single wagons and double wagons and all. And this was in 1906. And we had him make a nice delivery wagon for us. And we have it today. And we've told Joe that they could have it to put up in the Ricka Museum. It's still in good shape, and it was made in 1906. Well, that hardware store was right where Chain Apparel is now. And back in those days, I was superintendent of schools. Well, it was a pretty minor job then. You didn't get much of anything, but you had to. The Halton schools, and there were five or six small schools in the outlying district. And you had to supply teachers from all, and now believe me, it was some job. But nevertheless, it was interesting at times. I well remember they had a rule at the high school that if a boy needed to be punished, they would send him down to the principal. Well, every few days there'd be some boy come down with a note from the teacher at Heed Saster or something like that. Well, I'd take him in the office and tell him to sit down. And we sold whips then, and the whip people had given us a very fancy, big, heavy whip. And I'd take the boys, of course I never touched one of them in the world, I'd take the boys in there and I'd have them sit down. I'd excuse myself. I'd get to go out and wait on customers. But as I would go out, I'd take this whip down laid across the chair. Well, that seemed to have quite a good effect. Well, after a while, I'd go back and tell the boy he could go. But I remember one fella that came down. He was a senior, and they'd had an awful time with him at Ricka. And I've always been very pleased that I did that. They couldn't do anything with him. And John B. Madigan, Jim Madigan's father, was chairman of the school committee. And I know that this fella, well, was a very brilliant fella, and he was going to go to medical school. So I arranged and had him go over and had Mr. Madigan talk to him. And I went over with him. And I've often wished I could have had that recorded, for it changed his whole life. He settled down, and he was one of the top-ranking ones in his class, and he went to medical school and did well. And then, after he got through medical school, he located in Bangor and became a very prominent doctor there. But those were the days when things were happening at Ricka. Well, I remember well out there once, we had of course, Ricka was supposed to be very pure, and they had rules on this regulation for this tournament at Colby, that every student that was on the team should have been a registered student. Well, this year, this had been my senior year at Ricka, we needed a catcher and another good fielder. So there was Biddle Wyatt in town here, and Joe Sear, two French fellas, that they were very famous ball players. They both were brought up in the New England League. Well, to have them as good legitimate students, Mr. Felch was manager of the team.
Unfortunately, Mr. Putnam's tape ran out right at this point. So we'll never know what happened at Rickle when they brought the ringer in. We are going on to part of another tape, also done by Mr. Fred Putnam, of Holton, Maine, 91 years old in 1972.
Well, this day, we were having recess, and when the bell rang, of course, we all made to get in. Well, the steps, not being shoveled or anything, were all ice, and they weren't by. I was small, only about 6 years old, see. And I was pushed some way and went down and hit on the edge of the step about an inch below my hip joint and broke my leg.
Well, how I
can remember this. They carried me in and laid me on the settee where they did some fella most every day that had been knocked out, you know. Well, after a little while, I grew old, suffering terribly. And Bart Donovan, you've heard of him.
I remember him.
Bart was a nice, he was frightfully my age. And after a while, Bart came up and he says, "Miss Mulherron, he's suffering terribly. There's something wrong. I'm going to run up and tell his father." Well, out Bart went, came up and told Father, and he came down and got me. And this shows you the difference in what the doctors had to do, contend with then. And now he got me home, and of course, then Dr. Donald came. Well, he discovered my leg was broken.
Oh.
Well, they had no x-ray, and that was a very delicate, about an inch from the hip joint. Well, and oh my Lord, they never thought that they could set a bone for 3 days after the muscles got tamed down, and what I suffered for those 3 days. Well, then he got it set and got me in splints, you see, and this thundering sticking plaster from one side of your leg to the other, and a weight over the end of the bed. And each time that I had my leg broken, I was as flat on my back as that table is for 4 months, because if I moved, that went out.
Mm-hmm.
But every night for those 4 months, of course, before I could go to sleep, there were some friends that stayed there all night with us. I think of the people doing that.
Yes.
You saw the piece in the savings bank.
Oh, yes.
I remember. Well, that board of directors, who were the first board of directors I could remember, knew all of them. Well, of course, in those days, we knew everybody. Well, I can remember, and looking them over, there were four of those men that used to take their turn once a week, sitting up all night with me. And Father and Mother, of course, did a good deal of the time, but their friends greatly. Well, that went on. Well, that was number one. I was six. Well, then I got to be seven, and long in February, I was going out of the yard and it snowed, and apparently I twisted my leg or something and was broken again in the same place. And I went through that same thing. Well, then I got out of that. I was seven then. Well, I skipped my eighth year. I didn't break it. Well, then in the ninth year, when I was nine, Fred Frisbee owned the farm, what they call the Lowry Farm, up at the opposite the end of the Ludlow Road,
mm-hmm.
and he had cattle. Well, he used to let them run, and they were all an hour long. This was in August, and they were wet, and we prided ourselves on the lawn, and I ran to drive those cattle out of the yard and fell and broke it again. Well, that's how I could have told this so many times. I've been asked, well, this new man that bought the DNA,
coming, because we've become great friends, and he used to ask me, see, I've been on that board 32 years, and he is greatly interested in the early history of it. Well, the last time I saw him, he said, Fred, I've wondered how they, what they did with their potatoes before the V&A came into Houghton. Well, I says, it was this way. They didn't raise a quarter as many, and I can remember day after day of lying in bed there, three different winters, and my entertainment was counting the loads of potatoes coming down. And in those days, they, CP was in here, and they shipped the car occasionally. But I would see in the morning, this was especially in the winter, about 10 o'clock, there'd be 15 to 20 of these teams with long sleds with 25 or 30 barrels of potatoes on coming down the North Road. Well, they would be from Monticello and not little above there. Well, then along in the afternoon, about 2 o'clock, there'd be a steady stream of, there'd be teams from Bridgewater and Mars Hill. Just think of it, clear from Mars Hill coming down here with their potatoes. And they, the standard load was, all these long sleds would hold, would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 25 barrels. Well, they'd come all of that distance with that number of barrels of potatoes. And I remember Father and them talking, and they would get a dollar a barrel from them. And they would stay, have to stay here overnight. And it was quite a problem in those days from to get barns enough to put all the horses stuff at night.
Well, so how did they keep the potatoes from freezing, too?
Well, they had long sleds with double canvases over the potatoes, and they had lanterns in between the barrels.
Oh, come
and
on.
They washed them.
Yes.
And then, well, that was so. A great entertainment for me all the afternoon, watch them.
Well, now, Mr. Putnam, when did they keep on by team to ship them out of here down country, or?
Did they what?
Did they ship them down country from Houghton by team, or was the?
Oh, no, they went to the CP.
From then, I see.
From there, they sold them at the CP.
And that would take them to Bangor?
Well, they mostly went to Boston.
To Boston.
And it's quite that put near that way now. Nine out of families will think of, well, about potatoes. If they're not going to Boston, the Harlem River,
yes.
They don't know where they're going.
Yes.
Well, that was the way that went. But that's the way they got rid of the potatoes. And another thing that happened in those days that used to amused me a lot. There was and I'll bet there's no one else in town who'd remember this, there was a tannery up beyond the CP track where they made, an endless amount of bark to make it into leather, you know, and tan it. Well, anyway, that bark mostly was cut upon letter B. Well, it shows there were some pretty keen roosters in those days. And a man by the name of Milbury had a contract to haul all that bark down. Well, you wouldn't remember or know anything about what a bark rack was, but it was a long affair with stakes up and a binder going over the top. Well, they'd load this bark on, because it's a big job to load it, and then they'd have to get these binders down tight to keep it from upsetting and so forth. Well, these fellas hauled it by the cord, and it was scaled at the tannery up there. Well, these fellas with a load of bark, they would take a bag or two and put broken pieces in that bag, see?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when they got along front about by our home up there, that was his near. Okay. One fella would ease these binders up and the bark would spring up. Well, the fellow who had the load would take these broken pieces and fill in the ends. Well, that was a great show for me.
Sure.
And Father, they had been, just happened to have stopped there. Well, Father knew, of course, all those fellows, and he told them about it. And they made it a rule to get parked just right, to stop just right, so I could see them. And I saw them do that day after day. And then they, the fellows would, Father told them, it was a news thread, if you tell them when you come back how many cards you gained that way. Well, they gained from 2 to 4 cards a load by putting those broken pieces in the end. So pretty bright fellows in those days.
I would say so. I never thought of leather being made out of bark.
Well, the bark was part of it to help tannage, you know.
I see. That's
what they did out to New Limerick. That was quite an industry out there.
They burned the bark, you mean?
They grounded.
I see.
Yeah. And that house there where Linwood Hand lives,
mm-hmm.
was the Shaw, had this tannery out there. And, well, you'll remember funny things that happened. The Shaws, of course, were quite prominent people, and they belonged to various things in Houghton, see. And Mrs. Shaw, or like a lot of the women that came in here in those days, they were kind of trying to bring the other people up to their ideas and so forth. And they, I'll never forget this, they had a Shakespeare club that most of the women in town belonged to. My mother did, and a lot of them. Well, and she belonged to it. Well, they entertained them round at the different houses. Well, I'll never forget the black looks they got there. They invited them to come out to New Limerick. Well, they arranged with the B&A to run a car out to New Limerick this afternoon for this Shakespeare meeting with the Shaws. Well, they expected all to go to the Elephant Shaw home. Well, I'd be danged if they got at the station and there wasn't a long sled with stakes on it. They could stand on that and hang on to sled. They get on and they brought up down to that old North Star Hall. And that's where it was. So say they never went to New Limerick again.
Ah, and they were all dressed in their fancy clothes.
Oh, Lord, yes, they nearly froze.
Riding on the sled. Oh, my.
Oh, what?
I knew that the school out there has always been called the Tannery School, I think.
Oh, yes. But the Shaws did a lot for the community out there. And the thousands and thousands of cord of bark that they bought.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I was originally, all of these things that you say go back and relate so to the history of the area, but I was going to ask you particularly about horse racing.
About what?
Horse racing.
Well, I'll tell you. Of course, I was mixed up in that more than... Yeah. Well,
say that again about the hardware store.
Yeah, back in those days, Arthur and I, we had the hardware store, and we took on the agency for Maytag Washers. Well, they had a convention, and we got the business built up, so we had the courage, and we'd ordered a carload of Maytag Washers. Those were the first washers that came in here. Well, anyway, then they had a big banquet in New York, and they invited all carload order fellows to this banquet. So Arthur and I went, of course. Well, I've thought of this many times. Will Rogers spoke, and he made one of his famous speeches. And then he looked down at us, stepped forward to the stage, says, "You fellows all look pretty young." He says, "I'm going to tell you a few things that I've kind of, as he put it, absorbed and knocking around the country as I do. I'll tell you right now, the first fella that you do a favor for, will be the, if the cards are ever against you, he'll be the first one to stick a knife in your back. And another thing he said was that you'll find, and I could prove this all right, you'll find that it isn't wholly what you know, it's the, what your friends know and the influence that they have. Well, I've thought of that many times. When I, is that?
Yes.
I thought of that many times. It was very fortunate for me that I went to Bowdoin, and fortunate for Ricker. For when I came, I was chairman of the board at Ricker, and we had no gymnasium. Well, Roy Byther saw in some school paper that Congress had just passed the Lanham Act, which would allow the government to furnish money to build gymnasium for schools. Well, instantly, I called Senator Brewster, who was a Bowdoin friend of mine. We belonged to the same fraternity and were both overseers at the same time. And about it. Well, he says, yes. And he says, I'll make appointment with General Fleming for you. He was the man that Truman had appointed, see, to have charge of all this school donations in the eastern half of the United States. So he made the appointment with General Fleming. And he wrote me when it was to be. Well, of course, if I hadn't known Brewster, I would have been down in the station, yes. Well, anyway, then he says, I would suggest, Fred, that when you acknowledge that and tell him you'll be there, casually bring it in as your stranger, you'd be glad to give him some references. It'll help you. So I happen to have been a great, a good friend of President Sills of Bowdoin. He was in Bowdoin. Well, then I knew President Johnson awful well at Colby, and I was on the Potato Tax Committee of Maine then, and that way I got awfully well acquainted with President Hauk of Maine. So I put those three down. Well, then Horace Hildreth was a Bowdoin fellow in the same fraternity and an overseer too at Bowdoin. He was governor. Put his name down. Well, then, of course, Curtis Hutchins was president of the B&A, so I put that gave me my five names. Well, I'll never forget that morning I get back there and I was half scared to death. I went alone, see, and that was a trump card, as he told me afterward. And when I got there, I went in and I found that those army officers, I met quite a number of them. There was none of this inherited authority. They had worked up, and they were very human.
See? Yes.
And General Fleming, and he greeted me very cordially, and he says, we really owe you $200. I said, oh, how, I appreciate that, General. How did I earn that? Well, he says, I tell you, if you hadn't given me a list of names like you did, why, it would have cost us around $200 to have Dun and Bradstreet look you up and look the school up. And he says the fact that you were able to give a list of names like that certainly registered with us. And another thing he says that's going to help you immensely, Brewster tells me that you're up here alone and that you're paying your own bills. And I says, yes, that's right. Well, Aaron says, I'll explain that to you. He says, many times, in cases like yours, there'd be this committee, about three come in. Well, and they'd be all up here at the school's expense. And I tell you now, none of them lived on sandwiches. They went to the best hotels. Well, then we would have our meeting of the committee, like I've got to do with you. And some fellow would say, well, now if they've got money to send three men up here at their expense and all of that, they don't need our money. But when I tell them that you're paying your own bills and you're alone, it'll register, but gosh, it did. And when I, well, then I had to go back twice to see him different things afterwards. And no one could ever been treated nicer than he treated me, see.
And you got the grant.
You what?
You got the funds without any, yes.
And I wished everybody in Houghton could have the feeling. Well, I tell you, I asked for $300,000, see. Well, and I had to come home and get the plan, everything, and the architect, and take him back and meet him again in Boston, in New York, or Washington, which I did, and I paid their bills and paid the architect's expenses there, and so forth. And then they wanted to know the population of Houghton. Well, I had figures then. It had been given 8,800 people, and then everything I thought was all approved, the size of the building, everything. I get back home, and Brewster called me, and he says, General Fleming's called me, and he's very sorry, but he thinks it would be wise for you to take your plans and come to Washington again. Well, away I went. Well, I got there, and they had an architect, government architect, had figured that we could cut out about 50,000 to cut our building down and do away with that big stage.
Oh.
Well, I finally monkeyed around and argued with them and finally got that. Then another thing they brought up was that the General Fleming hadn't brought up before, but I anticipated it, that the Lanham Act read for public schools. Well, we weren't classified as a public school. Well, he brought that up, and I says, yes, I've been expecting that, General. But although the only difference between us and the Houghton High School is they can go into town meeting and raise money,
yeah,
where we can't. But there are 23 towns that I had this all prepared, 23 towns that we have boys and girls attending RICA who do not have a high school. And I had my list of the whole, and pulled that out. And he says, oh, by golly, I guess you won that. Well, how good I felt. Well, anyway, then we got the whole thing straightened out.
Of course, that changed your population figure, too.
Yes. Well, then that day, I'm not telling this to flatter myself or anything, but I guess he had the confidence in the fellows that had recommended me. He says, I tell you, ordinarily we'd have to have all sorts of looking you up in the RICA and everything, but I'm going to do away with that, and I'm going to tell the mechanics of this whole thing is done in the New York office, and I'd been there two or three times, a man by the name of Mr. Jones ran it. He says, I'm going to telephone him and tell him the story. Well, then he says to Louise, the secretary, says, get Bill Jones in New York. Well, I was just holding my breath. And he says, well, I'm sending Putnam back to you again. Now you go ahead and make out the papers and do everything. I'm going to okay $336,000 for RICA Classical Institute, and I'm going to do away with all that red tape. I'm going to have you put in our contract that he has to sign all vouchers personally. Well, I just wondered what the... But anyway, of course, we never saw any money. As the contracts came in, the architect okayed them. Well, then I had to sign them. Well, that way we got the $336,000 and got the whole shooting. But there was certainly one on me. I've thought of this many times since. At that time, there'd been a lot in the paper about well, so many thousand barrels of paint put in the dump over here. Well, and this morning I was in General Fleming's office and he was called on the phone. He was talking and this nice looking young waitress, secretary looked up. He says, "Mr. Putnam, isn't it your town where it's in the New York papers a few days ago about so many potatoes being dumped?" And I says, "Right there it was. There's no arguing about that." "Well," says, "I wish you'd have brought me a bag." "Well, I want to be the good fella and get," I says, "well, now you just put your name down." I pull out a little notebook there, "and I'll see that you have a good bag of 50-pound bag of potatoes next fall." Well, I was back in there and she goes out, and then she had an assistant that took her place when she went to lunch. And I'll be danged if that other little girl, when she came in, and she says, "All right," and she says, "Well, Louise appreciated an awful lot your sending her a bag of potatoes." Well, of course, there I was elected for another bag. Well, I had to go back. Well, then I got to New York and went into Mr. Jones' office. He was the easiest fellow in the world to meet, great big Western fellow. And his secretary says, "Well, Mr. Putnam, we were hearing about you from New York, from Washington. Louise Fleming's secretary was telling me that you very generously are going to send them each a bag of potatoes." "Well," I says, "I, gosh, I'm not going to let them have anything on you. You folks put your name on here." Well, going back and forth, well, then I was there a couple of days and saw several of them, and every danged office I went, those damn potatoes come on. Well, I was game. I says, "Yes." So I got to Boston, and I had to go into the Boston office because they were going to turn a lot of Western lumber that they had bought at a good price over to Ricker at the price they bought it. Well, I had to put that through the Boston office. Well, I goes into this office and everyone was just surrounded by secretaries. And I'll never forget this little secretary looked up one of the others and says, "You know, that's the man that is going to send them some potatoes in Washington, New York." Well, I said, "There's five of you, put your names on here," and they did. Well, when I got done, when I went through the same thing, when I went back and went through it again, when I got done, I had 48 50-pound bags of potatoes that I had promised that I would send them. So I lived right up to it. Well, then when we dug potatoes that fall, I picked out a hill where we had potatoes, where I knew they'd be drier and right size, and I put Jimmy Campbellton and his wife on to put up 50 bags of the right size, around a 12-ounce potato is what the choice size. Well, then I token prepaid the express and sent all of them. And of course, if you send anyone a present, a bag of potatoes, you, the first line in your, the acknowledgement you get, they never had such nice potatoes and all of that. Well, I got all those letters. Then I got a letter from a Mrs. Some Hood, and her father was in the New York office. He was the one that wrote the checks, and she said that they enjoyed the potatoes, but she wished I would write her how we planted them and what we did to have them all grow the same size, if she'd like to have her father plant some in the garden. Well, I told her, I says, I'll tell you, I had a man and a wife spend 3 days picking out 50-pound bags to get them the same size and all, but I got a great kick out of those potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
But everybody was so, what a change it was everywhere I went. I knew that would come up. You see, when I got to Boston, I think, say, oh, by golly, we've outlived the damn potatoes. Well, I got there, and the first thing this girl says to the one of them, she says, now that's the man that is offered to send a so-and-so in Boston, Washington, in New York, potatoes. But anyway, we got the gym, but that was, of course, that was after it was all over.
Yes. They could search the rest of their lives and they'd never buy 50 pounds of potatoes and have them all the same size.
No, oh no.
They'd never have
but
that.
They were put up for, but I was right on to that anyway. This Jimmy Camp,
yes.
At that time, the B&A was sending out about 1,000 16-pound boxes a year,
yes.
To people. Well, I had our crew put them up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this Jimmy Campbellton and his wife put them up.
Were able to, yeah.
Gosh, I'm keeping you from your story that you...
Well, I think what I'm going to have to do, Mr. Putnam, is come back and get you another day on horse racing, because we're running out of time.
Well, I'm sorry. I apologize for, gosh.
Look.
I shouldn't have talked this stuff.
This is just as interesting.
Yeah.
But I know several people had said to me, get Fred Putnam to tell you about horse racing, because he's been interested in horses, and he has owned horses.
Yeah, well, I, not to flatter myself, but I, with Cecil McGinley gone, I'm the only one left of that horse crowd, so to speak. Cecil and I had told, well, we told Bunny Estee once that we would sit down with him and dictate the story to him on that. We were all in it, and so forth.
Who else besides Cecil were the horsemen in this area?
Well, back in those days, Lee Irvin and Bud Tingley, Cecil McGinley, Andrew Saunders, Murdoch McKay, and Cecil McGinley and Al Moores, there was a bunch of us, about 8 or 10 of us. We were connected with the Fair Association, and this horse business doesn't sound quite so foolish as people would if they didn't realize that it was why we did it. We had this Fair Association, and I have to be president of that for a number of years there, and we tried to run the fair, and unless we had one mighty big day, we knew we'd have to sign notes at the bank to pay the premiums, which we did.
Sure.
But then, lo and behold, the way to have your big day was to have a feature race, the free-for-all. And the people had got so they wanted them to go a little faster than they were going, and you'd have to have the big premiums, good horses. Well, Presque Isle went ahead, and they were very fortunate. They bought a horse, John R. Braden, which was a, if there is such a thing as a perfect horse, he was. He could step in 10 and was perfectly mannered. Well, of course, that worked good, and Then we...
Mr. Putnam, what do you mean he could step in 10?
Trot a mile in 2:10 seconds.
Oh, 2:10, yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, then that went good. Well, then lo and behold, Caribou bought a pretty good horse. And Woodstock showed up with a pretty good. Well, I mustn't take your time to
this
tell...
This is what I want to hear.
Well, anyway, we were suddenly up against it here. And Lou Powers, that would be Judge Powers' son, was here. The judge had died and left Lou quite a lot of land in Florida. And Lou had sold it a good deal more than he ever expected. And Lou says to the Fair Association, we were debating about to do about to get a thundering horse. And we hadn't any money. And Lou says, well, I tell you, boys, I've been lucky on that land in Florida. I'll buy a horse. And we got track of this Calgary Earl. Well, he came and he had quite a record and so forth. And the first big race was to be at Woodstock. And he was to start there. Well, Harry Nevers was training him, and Harry was a nice fellow and a darn good driver too. And he was stepping miles here and very easily in 8 and 10 and along there. And we supposed that he would be stand a good show of winning at Woodstock. So this great day came up, and oh, how they poured down from Presque Isle and up country over to Woodstock. And I drew lots, see who would go. Well, I drew the lot to stay home. Well, then there was Rupe Irvin in the next door, and then Joe Robinson, and Ed Sterrett, and Smith Brothers, and six or seven of us up through there who stayed home, pulled in and arranged with the telephone people to have an open wire when this race came on and have this girl announce it. Well, so we assembled, we knew about what time out front there, and there quite a few gathered around to hear it at our expense. Well, the first 3/4 of a mile, there was nothing to it but Calgary Earl, our horse. Well, then he broke, and that was the trouble with him. That's how we were able, Lou was able to buy him.
Uh-huh.
Broke. And to get him to go in, he couldn't. Well, we waited and waited, and the waitress, girl there kept saying, well, he can't seem to get him started again. Well, then she says, well, now I'm sorry to announce to you Houghton people, but John R. Braden, they've gone under the wire, and the starter has announced that John R. Braden wins first money, and he went in 2:08. Well, and she says, the only thing I can, now this is where we felt pretty sick. She says, the only thing I can say to you Houghton people is, I'm awful sorry, but I can't keep the line open any later. But later on, if your horse goes under the wire, I'll call you back. Oh, God. We never heard the last of that.
Well, to which town did Jackson Grattan belong?
Oh, Houghton Horse.
Well, that was, well, wasn't, didn't he beat John R. Braden?
No.
Never?
Oh, no.
Oh, I thought he was quite a horse.
Oh, he was a wonder, but how we was suckers in a way in getting, now that horse of Lou's would go out in alone at Calgary Earl. He'd go up here at the park, we'd go up there and watch him, and he was just playing along a mile in 2:10.
Yeah.
See, but when you got him with other horses,
yeah,
he'd break. Well, then you really had to take him back to the barn,
yeah,
start over again.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget how we looked at one in the crowd when, later on, if he goes under the wire, I'll call you back.
Oh. Who was the big Woodstock horse that would be racing against John R. Braden?
What was his name?
Yes.
Peter Simonson, they called him.
Peter Simonson.
Yeah, it's a
yeah,
funny name. He was named after some owner.
Yes. Well, the four towns then.
Oh yes, that
raced,
was.
That
yeah,
was.
Well, of course, our point in getting a good horse was that to have a big race
sure,
here.
Sure.
But.
Well, was John R. Braden ever defeated?
No.
He never was?
No. Of course, they were very lucky. They got the perfect horse and perfectly mended, and they had one of the nicest men that I ever met, and a great jockey, John Willard. He'd be a distant relative of our town manager here.
Oh, really?
He was a wonderful elderly man.
Yes.
And he trained the horse, and he always say how Presque Isle went wild over that horse. They had a, after he'd, we'd raced our Jackson Grattan up there the first time, and of course he'd beaten them and so forth. Why, they had a banquet at the hotel, a big banquet, and they brought John R. Braden in.
I'd heard that story.
Oh, yeah, that's the fact.
Yes.
I was, they invited a lot of the mourners in. Well, I know I was head of our fair association, and so I took Bud Tingley and Lee Irvin and Murdoch McKagan. We went up and attended this. Well, then, when he had to lay him away, finally, they've got a nice monument in the park to it.
Was he a gelding or did he have any lines?
Beg your pardon?
Was he a gelding or did he have any lines?
No.
No.
Oh,
he was a gelding?
Yes, he was. He was a beautiful horse. If he hadn't been a gelding, he'd been worth thousands of dollars more for breeding purposes. But he was a beautiful horse.
Where did they get him, Mr. Putnam?
They picked him up in New York.
Oh.
But this Jackson Grattan, I'll never forget. Well, I'll tell the story, and I'll tell you later when you put it into the story. But one thing that always remembered was that we sent Dr. Henderson. We had to start out, and being head of the fair association, I had to kind of draft fellows to help us. We were going to save the fair by getting that horse here and having our feature race on this big day and so forth. But of course we sent them to New York and they came back, reported about him stepping this mile in a quarter in 30 seconds. Well, we thought that was great and so forth. Well, then, after interfere with the story later on, that isn't recorded.
Yes, it is.
But anyway, he did that, and they came back and told us about that. Well, then we proceeded to raise the 12, which turned out to be $12,000.
Oh, my.
But one thing that we didn't realize at the time, there was an old jockey with three or four horses at the park by the name of Frank Fawkes, who had been in the Grand Circuit. And he was a friend of Walter Cox's. He was the one that had told us about Jackson Grattan. But when they came back, we voted to start this campaign, and they tried to get a price on him from Walter Cox. Well, he says, well, you